Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Kristen Turner, and today I'm speaking with Anne Searcy, author of Ballet in the Cold War, A Soviet-American Exchange, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. This book joins in the conversation about cultural diplomacy between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War by focusing on tours of the U.S. by the Bolshoi Ballet in 1959 and 1962, and two tours of the USSR undertaken by American troops when the American Ballet Company visited the Soviets in 1960, and when choreographer George Balanchine returned to the country of his birth in 1962 with his New York City Ballet Company. Although geopolitical tensions have their place in this book, Searcy is more concerned with the reception of these tours by Soviet and American critics and how they filtered their opinions on the dances and performers they saw through local aesthetic debates tinged by political realities. Anne, welcome to the podcast. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Thanks. It's lovely to be here.
Wonderful. So you are a musicologist and you work as a musicologist, but this is a book about dance. So how did you come to this topic and just studying dance in general as a musicologist?
Well, I just have always really loved dance. I am not in any way an accomplished dancer, but I like doing it. So I did it as a kid. And I did some other styles of dance in college. But I mostly just really, really love watching dance. And so I basically knew that I wanted to work on the relationship between music and dance. Basically, before I went to grad school, I flirted with some other topics that I thought maybe would be more like musicology-ish. And then I read Apollo's Angels by Jennifer Homans, and I had such, which is a history of dance, sorry, history of ballet. And I had such a fun time reading that, and I just thought, I'm crazy. I can't possibly do anything other than music and dance. So that's how I got to dance. But then I love that book, but the chapter on Soviet ballet just really didn't reflect any of the things that I'd seen when I was watching Soviet ballet, because I'd spent, or Russian ballet, but from the Soviet period that was continued on, because I'd spent the summer in St. Petersburg watching a lot of ballet live while I was doing a language program. And I got to that section of the book and I just thought, this does not describe what I've seen at all. And I think it's a very accurate representation of what English speaking audiences think they know about Soviet ballet. And in particular, in that chapter, there was a discussion about the Soviet-American tours, and there was this encounter that's in the book as well, in my book as well, of the Bolshoi came in 1962 to the United States, and they performed Spartacus, and there was like a lot of hype for it, and people were really excited about it. And then on opening night, the American audience hated it, and they started booing. And they booed, I think, a long time. And there are a lot of accounts of how bad this performance went and how upset everyone involved was. And I just wanted to know about it. It seemed so unusual. And the accounts that I was reading about it were that this was a really boring, like, kitschy ballet. And I had seen it performed in Russia the year before, and I just thought, that's not what I saw at all. So what happened that these Americans all watched it and saw something kitschy and horrible that they had to boo, rather than what I had seen, what I thought I had seen, which was something like really exciting, and particularly like intellectually engaging. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
No, it's interesting how so often people write a book because they see something a little strange and they think, I wonder what that's about. And suddenly, you know, years later, there's a dissertation or a book about it. So that's an interesting story. So this is a book about cultural diplomacy. And you are writing about a period that was, you know, the height of the Cold War, such a period of tension between these two countries. Just to sort of set the stage before we get into those particular tours, you know, why did they even do cultural diplomacy? Mm-hmm. You know, what was the goals of the U.S. and the USSR in trying to engage in that way?
So as I did the research for this book, I actually discovered more than I had imagined that this is the U.S.-Soviet direct exchange is a really weird subset of what actually goes on in cultural diplomacy, or what went under in cultural diplomacy during the Cold War, which was mostly the US and the USSR sending out performing arts groups to other countries. And then it starts making a lot more sense, because the Cold War was hugely about those two countries trying to control the rest of the world, and particularly trying to control the newly decolonized areas of the world. And so there were a lot of the Soviet Union in particular started doing this post-World War II to send out their orchestras and ballet companies to lots of different places all over the world, to India, to Cuba, to gain support in those areas. So by sending those tours, the government was just cultivating allies in other parts of the world, making people, you know, grateful to the Soviet Union that they'd sent something beautiful that everybody could now watch, and impressed that the Soviet Union could put something so spectacular together as the ballet. And the U.S. started doing this basically to keep up with the Soviet Union. The direct exchange between the U.S. and the Soviet Union actually makes a lot less sense. There's a really interesting book by Kirill Tomov trying to deal with, like, why did these people agree to do this? But basically they were trying to gain some kind of upper hand by having that exchange. But there's always like this anxiety that goes on in it as well about like, worry that the other person will get an upper hand in it. Like if you could gain something, maybe they could gain something. So there's this real, focus on reciprocity baked into all the agreements between the USS and the USSR that's trying to like control what the other person, what the other side could possibly achieve out of this. But they were basically trying to, even in this direct exchange, gain influence, gain sympathy. And on some level, there's also like people who are trying to lessen the possibility of nuclear war. This was really only possible after the death of Stalin in 1953, and the U.S.-Soviet exchange becomes formalized in 1958. Because Stalin just believed that World War III was absolutely inevitable. The U.S. and the Soviet Union would be fighting it like any day now. And so there would be no point in doing cultural exchange in that situation. The leaders after he died were more believing that like an agreement could be reached, or that like communism could win out eventually without a war. And so we're more willing to have to try to lessen the possibility of military conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Well, that brings up another question that I had, which was, especially for American ballet companies, why would they go to Russia to dance? I mean, it's sort of, I think anyway, of Russia as, or the Soviet Union as sort of the home of classical ballet. I would think that they had much more to lose than they would have to gain to take part in that cultural exchange. So can you talk a little bit about kind of why these ballet companies agreed to do it and sort of what was at stake for them as they undertook these tours?
So they had the exact same worries that you have. They were very, very concerned. Russia absolutely was considered the home of ballet, the best at ballet by people in Russia and by most people in the US, including most dance experts. But money, money, money. They really needed the funding from the State Department. Like the American Ballet Theater and New York City Ballet and a number of other companies that I don't talk about in the book in the U.S. really relied on funding from the State Department to keep going during this era. And they talked about that very explicitly in meetings. So it's that, but it's also like the prestige of having gone to the Soviet Union. So there's like the direct money that you get from doing the tour. But then there's also the like publicity that they got from having done the tour. So particularly American Ballet Theater was really strongly motivated by that. Like they wanted to position themselves as the United States' national ballet company. And so going on a tour to the Soviet Union was a way of gaining that prestige. But I think for New York City Ballet, a lot of it was the money. They really wanted to go on a tour of Western Europe, and this was the like pill that you take to go on the tour of Western Europe, is going on the tour of the Soviet Union. And Balanchine was very anxious about being asked to do that. He really didn't want to go to the Soviet Union for a number of like personal and political and artistic reasons. He was just very upset about it.
You've talked about this just a little bit, but I want to just dig in specifically. Why did you pick these four tours? So, you know, there's, as you said, there's a long history of cultural diplomacy there. I'm sure there were other tours you could have chosen, but you chose these four tours, the two by the Bolshoi and then the two by the American companies. Why focus in on just those four?
So I was really interested in doing the start of the exchange. So 1959, when the Bolshoi came to the U.S., was the first time a ballet troupe from the Soviet Union had performed in the United States. And 1960, when American Ballet Theater went to the Soviet Union, it was the first time an American ballet troupe had performed in the Soviet Union. So I was really interested in looking at the first time that people in each country saw the other side's ballet, because I'm so interested in like that moment of reception and not understanding and like seeing a new thing that you think that you're going to understand, but don't actually understand. And then the 1962 tours, I really wanted to do the New York City Ballet's tour. And that was in 1962. And I thought about, there's a Soviet tour in 1961 that's also really relevant by the Kirov in the US. And I sort of went back and forth between covering that one and covering the Bolshoi's 1962 tour. But I picked the Bolshoi's for a few reasons. First, because that had the Spartacus debacle, and I really wanted to talk about that. And second off, because it was done in a very direct exchange with the New York City Ballet. So I mentioned how much reciprocity was on everybody's mind and how anxious they all were about it. And so in 62, they tried to solve that by arranging it so that the Bolshoi would be in the U.S. at the same time that the New York City Ballet was in the Soviet Union. And actually there was like financial obligation involved in that tour as well, but between the two companies and the impresarios. And then there's a third practical reason, which is that I was in Moscow and all the Bolshoi's documents are in Moscow. And to get to the Kirov's documents, I would have had to go to St. Petersburg. It would have just been really hard. It would have made the project almost impossible in terms of logistics, whereas covering two of the Bolshoi's tours was very possible.
I always feel like students have no idea how much of our research is just like, this was open, this was not, right? You know, there's always sort of those logistical things involved in deciding on projects.
The St. Petersburg archives are kind of legendarily harder to get into and harder to deal with than all of the archives in Moscow, which are sort of very bureaucratic and like open is not exactly the word I would use, but yeah, open. Like if you have the right paperwork and you go at the time when it says it's open, you can get all the documents. And so I really appreciated that. And the Bolshoi Theater itself So that what I was talking about is the state archives. The Bolshoi Theater also was very generous. Actually, one of the nicest archives I worked in. So they have an in-house archive and museum, and those archivists just like let me in basically whenever I wanted to come and like brought me whatever documents I wanted to see and let me photograph everything. They were really, really nice. It was a great place to work.
Wow, that's wonderful. That makes the whole world better when you can do that. So normally when I'm doing these interviews, I tend to sort of go through the book front to back. But I was so struck by one particular encounter that I thought really just wrapped up so many of the themes in the book that I wanted to start with that. And that was the reception in the USSR of the ballet Aegon by the New York City Ballet, which was, you know, the music is by Stravinsky, which another Russian emigre or exile. And but it's 12-tone music. And though you describe the ballet itself as quite abstract, there is what you call an erotic pas de deux between Arthur Mitchell, who was the only Black dancer in New York City Ballet, and Allegra Kent, a white woman. And it seemed like a lot of the things that American critics talked about that pas de deux and that opera, and also how the Russians understood it, really just kind of put a bow on so much of what you were talking about in the book. So maybe we could start there, and just if you could just go through some of the areas of reception and how, and tie it into the larger themes of the book, I think that would be a wonderful way to start.
I think in order to understand this, it's good to start with the ways that Americans understood how meaning was working in ballet, and how people in the Soviet Union were understanding how meaning was working in the ballet. So on the American side, Balanchine was really the leader of this movement that saw abstract ballet as better and wanted to use music to achieve that abstraction. So if you mapped choreography very closely on the music, Balanchine thought you would create abstract dance. And there are complications there, because he also talked about having people on stage as sort of inherently suggesting a story to the audience, but he didn't want to stage that story. And he really wanted to explore like form and texture, like musical things with the bodies on stage. In the Soviet Union, music definitely had meaning. Like there is an ideology that all arts have a meaning. And in fact, in this sort of Stalinist period, that they have one meaning and you can know what that meaning is and it better be the right meaning. By this point, there was sort of agreement that you could have more than one meaning, but it definitely, like, a work of art had meaning, music had meaning, and dance would be musical if it displayed that meaning. So they're also reading music as being very, very different. So in the US, Aegon was considered like the absolute height of this style of ballet that Balanchine was creating, that's abstract and it's really tied with the music. And Balanchine and Stravinsky created that piece in tandem, and it's very complicated and intellectual, and about like the many divisors of the number 12 and like how things are arranged on stage in that way. But it does have this pas de deux between Mitchell and Kent on tour, though she wasn't the original dancer in that part. But specific Mitchell, it was created for Mitchell. So it was supposed to be for a Black man and a white woman. And, you know, Balanchine always insisted that this was about the sort of abstract qualities of skin color and like seeing the dark and the white skin color coming together and mixing. But it is also being staged in the 1950s in the United States. And there is an inherent political meaning behind that decision. And I don't think there is any dance historian, music historian today that would disagree with that statement. And Claire Croft is another dance historian who's covered these tours, has discussed that for the U.S. State Department, for Balanchine, for the leaders in the New York City Ballet, Aegon was the height of abstraction and therefore couldn't say anything about race. But at the same time, they loved it because the State Department loved to have African American performers on these tours because they knew it, the U.S. looked really bad internationally because of racism and violence against Black people in the U.S. and people around the world knew about that. And so if they could put African American performers on tours, then they would never have to actually openly address those issues, but they could sort of just subtly say, like, look, how can we possibly be treating Black people badly? Here is one, and he is a dancer in the most important ballet company in our country. And so it, like, said things about race without having to say things about race, and they loved it for that reason. Well, the Soviets got to it, and they think that, you know, the music has meaning, or it should have meaning. And they did not like this score, almost any of it, because, you know, it's very deliberately scientific. And there wasn't a lot of exposure in the Soviet Union to 12-tone music, but there had been gradually over the 1950s, like, slightly more exposure to 12-tone music. And it was somewhat taking hold in, like, some avant-garde Soviet circles, but not in the ballet world, which just wasn't set up to do kind of avant-garde performances in that way. And also, a lot of the discourse that had gotten to the Soviet Union around it had, like, accurately reported things from the U.S. and Western Europe about 12-tone music being involved in math, which it is, and science, and it being related to those things. And so for the Soviet critics, they were really angry almost even at this ballet for not having anything to say about humanity. There's just, like, a lot of despair in those reviews about, like, dance is supposed to mean something, like, art is supposed to mean something and be about humanity, and this is not. And there's, like, almost like a really palpable distress in those reviews about how upsetting it is to them that Agon is created in this way and to this music. And because the dance is so closely matched to this music, they feel like the dance is just doing these same sort of exercises. But there is this weird pas de deux, and they agree to that as well, because if you've ever seen Agon, the pas de deux really is really different from the rest of the ballet. The rest of it is all, like, sort of, like, little jumps, and the music is sort of like a little beepy and boopy. It's, you know, it's woodwinds and strings. It's not a computer, but it sounds very, it sounds like 12-tone music. It sounds very, like, sort of disjointed in ways. I like it. I love it together. I think the music and dance go really well together. But, you know, the dance is doing the same things that the music is doing that they really don't like. But this pas de deux has these, like, long dissonant notes that just are really agonizing. And the choreography is done in a way you could read it as modernist abstraction if you were into that. But the dancers are in constant physical contact. They're, the woman is being, like, stretched really intensely by the man a lot of the time. There's even one section where, like, she's draped over his body with her leg up that looks both like a cross and kind of like the Pietà. So there's just lots of imagery in this that really does suggest meaning and suggest, like, some really intense emotional relationship between the two of them, and is also quite sexual. The woman, like, opens her legs up to the audience. It is a very different moment in this ballet, and the critics loved that, and the audience loved it. Like, reports of the first performance, the New York City Ballet and the Soviet Union talk about sort of a muted reception in the hall, and then, like, really strong applause for that pas de deux. And I think because, and so they started interpreting this as being very emotional, and mostly they attributed that to Mitchell and Kent, the dancers, rather than to Balanchine, the choreographer. And to some degree, that is actually true. Like, people talk about, particularly Mitchell doing it with Kent, as being more emotional and more sexualized than Mitchell doing it with Adams, which was his previous partner in the role. And part of it is the choreography just allows for more of that there. And part of it is that for a lot of the critics on both sides, it was much easier to applaud performers than choreographers because the performers seemed to be like less political. And they also got to talk about how that also let the critics sort of bring up racial politics in the US without bringing it up too much. So pointing out that they appreciated Mitchell, I think by implication more than the US did, was sort of a theme of those reviews. And one of the reviews even talks about that duet because they believe that, you know, dance has meaning, no matter what Balanchine says. One of them even brings it up as like a story about race in the US and like assigns roles to them of like, I'm sorry to use this language, but this is the language that the critic used, is a slave and his mistress is how she describes that pas de deux. So they were seeing a lot of these things in it that the State Department believed like were actually impossible to see in it. So, and it does speak, I think, to how differently these groups were viewing the same ballet, like the same thing is being performed on stage and just different people can see different things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, that is a lot of the theme of the book about how different, you know, the recognition is, or the misrecognition becomes, between these two groups of critics. So maybe we can talk about that for a little while. One aspect of that is what you touched on in this answer, which is, you know, in the Soviet Union, music always had meaning, but Balanchine and tons of other people in that period in the West, not just in America, really fought against that. This is about objectivity, that, you know, music is tones and form. And this is an old debate that goes back into the 19th century, at least. But I think a lot of people think that they're in the political context of that period. There are some political realities or political context that's important to understand within that debate. Do you agree with that? Or do you think that's primarily an aesthetic debate that is not as anchored in political concerns in that period?
I definitely think it's anchored in political concerns. I think there is a real aesthetic debate there. And then I think politics plays a role in how people cited and how strongly they felt about it. Because it's interesting, this actually does go back to the 19th century, but the debates in the 19th century weren't as acrimonious, and they were kind of acrimonious, but they weren't as intense, and they weren't as... the positions, I don't think, were as far apart from each other as they were talked about in the 20th century. So, like, you know, 19th century believers in absolute music did sometimes think that music could express emotion, or like it would have things to do with human reality. There was like a more middle ground, I think, in the 19th century. And in the 20th century, because these debates get mapped onto politics, they became so intense and so acrimonious. So yeah, the people who believed in absolute music, that music is just form and tone, tended to be in the West, and they tended to, so it became not just about associating, you know, music with formalism, but also about then associating that with freedom, that like, and this is a position articulated by lots of different thinkers in the West, including Adorno, that that by being the most abstract the artist could possibly be, they become free of politics. And so bizarrely then that gets mapped in the US onto capitalism and the freedom of like capitalism and democracy, which is like on some level hilarious that you can have a system of thought that is about thinking that you're completely free of politics as an expression of politics. And then in the Soviet side, because art was meant to be for everyone, they really wanted it to have meaning. But also, you know, each side seeing the other one got pushed further and further apart. I think particularly in the Soviet Union, like knowledge of European modernism and formalism pushed bureaucrats and critics further towards music has meaning. It definitely mapped onto politics, there is also a really interesting aesthetic debate in there about like what is the role of music and story and choreography in dance. And it is actually a debate that's been playing out in dance since like the 18th century about how do you express story on stage. Is it something that you can do purely through movement? Do you need the music? Is it wrong to express story and you should just be like expressing movement? And there are like cycles of that in ballet as well, as in music, and different ways of thinking about it. So there is actually a really interesting artistic debate. It's just almost in the Cold War, there becomes no middle ground or no way of talking about it because everybody is so entrenched in their ways of thinking about it.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that is, you know, obviously everybody knew that there was this debate going on in this sort of entrenched position. But it seemed like at least some of the ballet companies and some of the tours chose to program repertoire that they hoped would appeal to the sort of other side. And it just doesn't work. Like, so I'm sort of thinking of Spartacus in the Bolshoi Ballet, and I think Fancy Free in the first American tour was also dropped. So here they're thinking we're going to bring something that's really going to appeal to this other audience, and yet it doesn't work out. Can you talk a little bit about not only those choices to do that, but why those works just failed in those respective tours?
So I think the big mistakes that the companies made were less about trying to pick something that they thought would work in the other place, but trying to pick something that they thought just worked all the time and so would work in the other place. Although they were trying to create a certain image. So that's what's going on with Fancy Free too, is that American Ballet Theatre really wants to create like this image of what America is in the Soviet Union. And they have this repertoire from the 1940s of populist ballets with like everyman heroes that do tell a story and are about the like life in the US, and Fancy Free is one of them. And so they think they'll bring those to the Soviet Union. And Fancy Free went over pretty well. There are some similar themes between like those populist American ballets and socialist realist ballet from like the same period in the Soviet Union. But Fancy Free had some problems in the Soviet Union because of its dubious sexual morality, as the Soviet critics sort of talked about it. They were really anxious in the Soviet Union about American Western sexuality and about keeping those things out. And so like the characters in Fancy Free are all looking for a one night stand. And I think that did not go over that well. Spartacus was also sort of this like dual choice of that. Basically they did think it would go over well in the US, but that's because they thought that the American reception of it would be similar to the Soviet reception, that the Americans would see the same things that the Soviet saw, that it was this like epic ballet about somebody fighting for freedom. And they did know that the Americans had this like big film market of epic Hollywood biblical films like Ben-Hur and Quo Vadis and the Ten Commandments. Like all those things did really, really well in the box office in the US, and they knew that. And so they thought this would fill that void, and they did not calculate how little ballet audiences wanted to see that in the ballet, and how, like, I think that's where we get the stories that this ballet is so kitschy and horrible, is because they think it looks like a Hollywood biblical film, which, to be honest, it does. I actually think that the most productive times, ways these worked out, were when, instead of trying to sort of pick the ballet that each company thinks will portray themselves well to the other side, they pick the ballet that already is popular in the other place, or that has already proven itself, or is very similar aesthetically to ballets in the other place. Because like the Bolshoi brought ballet school on that same tour with Spartacus, which was like a set of graduation exercises for the Bolshoi Choreographic Academy. And it's like watching young dancers and then getting progressively older, doing sort of exercises on stage. In the Soviet Union, that was about education, but American audiences saw that and they thought it looked like Balanchine. And so they liked that. So things worked well, or classics worked really well. People, like, everyone loved Swan Lake. They did not see the same things in Swan Lake at all, but they all loved it. So that worked really well everywhere. And sort of choices like that, where things were popular in the location they were going. And other people who have written about cultural diplomacy, including Danielle Foster Lucier, have talked about similar things, that it really works when you're targeting the tastes of the audience and the repertoire in the location you're going to, rather than like how you want to be seen.
That's fascinating. What do you think? We've already talked about one big point of misrecognition, which is not agreeing on the meaning of music, right? And whether there is a meaning. What do you think are some other kind of touchstone differences between how American critics understood these ballets and how how Soviet critics were looking at them? What do you think is sort of one or two or three, however many, you know, like sort of fundamental differences that cause them to not really understand the ballets in the way that the other countries' critics understood their own works?
So the issue of meaning is really fundamental, and that plays into other aspects of difference between the way ballet is organized in the two places as well. It's particularly about story and length. Just in the Soviet Union, it was considered good to have your ballet telling a story. Like that was considered an aesthetic good. And in the US, it was not. And so American critics really didn't like almost any Soviet story ballet, because they just didn't think ballet should be telling a story. So they're brutal to Soviet ballets like Romeo and Juliet and Stoneflower and Spartacus. I think there's another misunderstanding about class and taste that goes on a lot, where in the US there had been this sort of conflict within dance about what the most tasteful form of dance, the most upper class form of dance is going to be. And ballet had been making its way up that hierarchy. But basically in the US, arts were used, among other things, to mark out sort of classes of people, like upper class, upper middle class, lower class, and like what type of art you liked was in like a marker of where you fell in there. And ballet had been like slowly making its way up. There's this like famous, and it's a joke, but you know, the best jokes are based in reality. A famous table from Life magazine showing like the likes and dislikes of people in various classes. And like a lot of it is a joke. It's like, what do you have in your salad, if depending on which one you are. But theater, the upper class person is clearly watching a Balanchine neoclassical ballet. They're watching The Four Temperaments, which is very similar to Agon. And so ballet in the U.S. was supposed to mark those things out. And the audiences for the Bolshoi were incredibly upper class. It was like really expensive to get a ticket. In some cases, you had to have a connection with the impresario already. Like, you had to already have been going to a lot of Solheurak attractions to be on the right list to, like, get first priority for tickets. And they were being scalped for outrageous amounts of money. And there were lots of, like, benefit evenings that were being held. And, like, everybody's dressed to the nines. And, like, in many cases, there are as long articles about these events talking about the audiences and what they were wearing as there are, like, reviews of the ballet. And in the Soviet Union, like, there was definitely a division in power, people who had, like, access to power and people who didn't, people who would have been able to go to these ballets, which were definitely people living in cities, usually members of the intelligentsia who have access to sort of going to tickets. But culture wasn't supposed to mark out high and low class. It was supposed to be something aspirational for everyone, that, like, the Soviet government would bring ballet and great art to everyone. And so the two sides also miss each other on that. And I think that's particularly a miscalculation in the Soviets coming to the US, not realizing who's going to be in the audience and what they want out of the ballet. And they want this in part as a status marker. And so that's, again, that everything goes back to Spartacus. That's why Spartacus did so badly. But they also say things about, like, other Soviet ballets being, like, really kitschy and tasteless, because they really don't. The Soviets planning these tours, I think, really did not get that aspect of how the arts are functioning in the U.S.
And also, I felt like it also runs up what I thought was interesting in the American reception is that this idea that the Bolshoi was old-fashioned and kitschy, in part because it wasn't upper class enough, like it didn't look classy enough for them. But on the other hand, you know, in other parts of classical music, the 19th century is it, right? It's all, you know, and so these big story ballets that sort of, I would have thought going in, not knowing anything about it, I would think, oh, you know, Spartacus would be great because it's this big 19th century seeming, you know, story ballet, or Swan Lake or whatever would appeal to them for that reason. But that doesn't seem to be the way it works out. So can you talk a little bit about that kind of tension between, you know, in the arts, the classical music and classical arts in America being so focused on old stuff, but yet somehow it's bad when the Bolshoi does something like that?
Oh, yeah, no, thank you. This is a really interesting, I think, question. And I think the solution to this is sort of part of the answer is that Swan Lake is great. They love Swan Lake. They just didn't like it when there was a new thing that looked like Swan Lake. So there's this belief in modernization that's very strong in the U.S. and the Soviet Union at the same time, but we will leave them to the side for right now. It's still prominent in our society. It gets me all the time. This belief that, like, the world is traveling along a set path to the future. There's, like, a way to get forward, and we all know what the way is. And this belief that arts have to move along that path. So it's almost the duty of the artist within modernism that the artist is, like, a little bit far forward from the audiences. I'm sorry, I'm chuckling because my students would so recognize me railing against modernization theory. and I'm trying to keep my cool. So there's this belief, and in the U.S., that's very tied to a belief in democracy and capitalism, like this belief that the world has sort of moved through its proper stages and has gotten to capitalism. And once capitalism and democracy encircle the globe, that essentially we'll get to the end of history. And this is also how you get in the 1990s, this belief that we have reached the end of history because the Soviet Union has collapsed. And they believed that as a result of that, the U.S. had the most sort of up-to-date, the West had the most up-to-date modern music, and 12-tone music was, and other types of modernism, we sort of reduce that to 12-tone music some of the time, but, like, modernist music was the cutting edge, and George Balanchine's ballet was the cutting edge of dance. And so they often seen the Soviets having done a different thing in the 20th century, almost like didn't compute. Like they just saw that it hadn't modernized the same way that they had modernized. And so to them, it was old fashioned. And that's one of the things that I find so surprising in these reviews is this constant accusation that things like Romeo and Juliet, Stoneflower, Spartacus are stuck in the 19th century. Where if you watch them back to back, they are not like Swan Lake at all. They're very different from 19th century ballets because the Soviets have invented all these new techniques for storytelling in the ballet. But because the Americans are not interested in storytelling, they just don't even recognize it as being different or new. So they liked it when the Soviets performed the classics because, as you mentioned, American audiences in the 20th century loved 19th century music. There's this real rise in sort of middle brow appreciation for the classics. But they can't like, and I will say the critics can't approve of Romeo and Juliet and Stoneflower. They can like it. And this is actually one of the other reasons I find Spartacus so interesting, because it seems like the audience didn't even like it. But like the audiences loved Romeo and Juliet. I mean, like applause that lasted like for 15 curtain calls for the first Romeo and Juliet. The dancers described it as like almost stunning. I interviewed Marina Kondratieva, who is one of the dancers, and she talked about those audiences being like the most appreciative they'd ever encountered. Leonid Lavrovsky was like writing about it in his letters home to his wife. And he's like, it was something furious. He talks about, with people like screaming and ripping up their programs and throwing them and like throwing flowers and like whistling. So they liked Romeo and Juliet. They just like couldn't admit, the critics couldn't admit that it was good. And so you get all these like contortions in the American critics to say like, oh, you know, the lead dancer is good. The ballerina is really good. No mention of, but the stuff she's performing is like, oh, it's so passe. It's so bad. But yeah, no, I think people liked Romeo and Juliet in particular. I think people really liked it. They just, you know, officially they didn't like it.
Well, boy, that's, you know, I study a lot of critical response in the turn of the century, and that sounds like exactly what they said about Carmen.
Like, oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the singing is so good. But, of course, it's a terrible opera, and it's all about the lowest common denominator and sex, 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 and you know, all of that. So, yeah, that definitely doesn't start in the 60s for sure.
Yeah.
You also found an interesting sort of gendered component to the way that some of these operas were received. You know, you talked about sort of the racial aspect of it, where it was very much in American, it's politically convenient for American critics to go, oh, there's no politics here when I see a black man and a white woman dancing together. But, and the Soviets, of course, are like, oh, yeah, I do believe there's something to be said here. What about this gendered aspect to the criticism as well?
Well, this happens, I think, particularly in the U.S., I mentioned they have to sort of explain how they like Romeo and Juliet, but don't like Romeo and Juliet. And the way they get around this is by talking about how much they love the lead ballerinas. And ballet in the late 19th and definitely in the 20th century was very much about women. So women are at the center of most ballets. But there's this split in the way people thought about ballet between the sort of performance aspects of it, which are considered sort of very feminine and almost like mindless. And it's, you know, it's all about emotion and expression and technique and the body. And it has very little to do with intellect or politics, which are sort of ascribed to choreographers and composers, and who were at the time in the U.S. and the Soviet Union, mostly men. In the U.S., mostly men in both sides. And so the U.S. critics liked to write a lot about how much they loved the Soviet ballerinas. And the U.S. press in general was just like, just following the ballerinas everywhere, like taking pictures of them, like reporting everything they did in the press, like treating them like Hollywood stars. And the critics talked endlessly about how much they loved the lead ballerinas, particularly Galina Ulanova and Maya Plisetskaya, but others as well got reported about. But they hated the ballets. And so they could separate this out using this sort of like gendered language they already had for both ballet and politics, to talk about how the sort of male parts, the political parts, the, you know, intellectual parts were bad, but they loved like non-intellectual parts as they saw it, which was the performance and what the ballerinas were doing. And there's also, there's like a slight tinge to it already at this point that the US is like rescuing those ballerinas by really appreciating them. And that kind of language about the US-Russian, US-Soviet relationship persisted a lot in American discourse through the Cold War and 1990s.
So you're talking about the gendered aspect of this. It's very interesting, sort of, I'm not so sure I like the opera, but boy, those beautiful women, kind of reception. But you also had something really interesting to say, I thought, about sort of critical discourse in the Soviet Union related to censorship, and particularly to how American musicologists, or at least non-Russian speaking musicologists, have thought about the relationship between criticism and censorship in the Soviet Union, and how the thought was for a long time that all censorship was top down and they sort of told people what they could say and that was that. But you're finding that post-Stalin, it's a little more complicated than that. And there were ways within sort of a rather rigid discourse where censorship did exist that critics really could have in some ways an open conversation. Can you talk a little more about that aspect of it? I found that particularly fascinating.
Thanks. I don't want to say I'm the first person to talk about this, because Soviet historians have been talking about this since the 90s, and musicologists about Soviet music for the last 10 years or so. Prior to this, prior to the archives opening in the 1990s, people in the West, in the English-speaking world in particular, really sort of believed that everything that was coming out of the Soviet Union was a lie to some extent, and that everything was censorship, and you could sort of never believe anything that was put in print or said in a speech because it was all politically motivated. And there's still a way that we talk about it now when people talk about totalitarianism. There's this belief that, like, the general secretary, you know, so Stalin, Khrushchev, sort of imposed their will on everyone and dictated what everyone in the whole country could say. But first off, that's not very practical. Like, Khrushchev had better things to do than think about what was getting printed in ballet reviews. By this period, sort of the late 1950s, the 1960s, it's called the thaw, censorship was being was almost more collaborative than top down. Like, there was a censorship bureau, but like they worked in collaboration with editors. They didn't really tell writers what to say. And there certainly was a sense of, I don't even love the word self-censorship, because it feels like there's like a thing that you want to say, but then you don't say it. But there was a knowledge of what the like right discourse would be that people talked into. But I think within that, there was like a much broader range of things that people could say about ballet than we've recognized. And this is particularly like really tough in ballet histories that you read about the Soviet Union. And I think this is where these myths about the Soviet Union are still persisting, is in a lot of English language ballet histories. There was, and sort of evidence for this includes, first off, there's a variety of opinions being expressed about the American companies, so they must have been allowed to say multiple things because they said multiple things. But also there's Elizabeth Suritz is a Russian dance historian who was a very young critic at the time. And she reviewed the company and she's written about it in an article about this. And she talks about both sort of generally knowing the like tone that she needed to take, which was actually a good tone. Like she knew that she had to say something nice about the company because otherwise there might be retaliation against Soviet companies, but also but she sort of doesn't talk about having any more censorship than the sort of knowledge of like what would be good to say. And she also talks about seeing the New York City Ballet in this way in the 1960s and remembering seeing it in that way that she no longer possesses and is even now like a little ashamed of having sort of seen the New York City Ballet in what she now sees as like the wrong way, but I would see as sort of like the Soviet interpretation in the 1960s. But yeah, so there was a lot of great variety of opinions. I think all of the reviewers had to have like a little statement about like, realism is important, and they all do. In some cases, it's like hilariously tacked on. Like there's a Khachaturian review that like goes through all the things, and then just like the last couple of lines is like, oh, and of course, realism is important. So I think they all knew they had to say that. But also, there's this like diversity of what socialist realism has even started to mean in the 1960s. And this is something that Alexei Yurchak, who's a sociologist of this period and slightly later, has talked about, that like by the late Soviet period, people were sort of like saying all the correct things and doing all the correct things, like the sort of like formulaic things they had to say and do, but they were sort of reimagining those things to mean new things, to have a variety of different meanings by this period. So I find socialist realism almost like a really interesting version of that, because in the 1930s and 40s, there was actually sort of a pretty clear sense of what socialist realism would sound and look like and mean. But by the 1950s and 60s, they're just sort of like deploying realism. That's the word that tends to appear. Socialist realism doesn't tend to appear, but realism tends to appear. There's a sense that they know what realism means. It gets deployed all the time, but like it could mean a lot of things. Like maybe realism is like enjoying the human body. Maybe realism is caring about like values like truth or beauty. Maybe realism is like having a narrative. So they all say like, oh, you know, of course realism is really important. And especially because Balanchine talked a lot about how like abstraction is really great in his interviews. So you had to say that he was wrong about that. But yeah, so there's like, yeah, it's realism is like not abstraction. But because abstraction is such its own sort of point of intellectual rigidity, that almost anything else that isn't, I don't even know what a pure abstraction would be in this case, like pure form with no thought at all, anything else could be realism.
I could ask a million other questions. I want to ask just one more before we wrap up our discussion. But I was really shocked. What a historical coincidence. There was an American troop in Russia, in the Soviet Union, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the Bolshoi was in America at the exact same time during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And yet it seems like, if I interpreted your book correctly, it didn't really impinge on the tour very much at all, despite, you know, I think about the Cuban Missile Crisis, like everybody stopped and for 4 days they worried they were going to be blown up, you know, by a nuclear bomb. And I sort of have this image of the world just not moving, you know, for days on end as they worried about this, but that's not really what seems to have happened. So I'd love to hear like what your ideas now are about the Cuban Missile Crisis based on the fact that these two groups could be there and they seemed relatively untouched. So like what happened to them and what do you think really what it was like to live through that period based on what you've learned?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I hadn't sort of thought about it in exactly that way before, but yeah, the two troops kept touring, kept performing, kept practicing. And to be honest, doing those things was really time intensive and really stressful under any circumstances. They had to perform a lot and sort of be on their best behavior all the time. So they basically just kept doing that. They were like vaguely aware of what was going on, but it couldn't stop what they were doing because they had to just keep practicing and performing. I do think, particularly in the U.S., there's some interesting stuff that happens in November, sort of after the official end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but while the U.S. and Soviet governments were actually still negotiating the terms of the agreement, and also while President Kennedy was sort of capitalizing on that moment domestically, where the, you know, Kennedys invited the Bolshoi, like they became a lot more involved in the tour during this period. So like Kennedy went to a performance, they invited the troop to the White House, which was not normal. they sent their daughter to another performance and there was like a gift exchange. They invited the company, like some of the company dancers, to Thanksgiving dinner at like Kennedy's mom's house in when they were in Massachusetts. So like there was like a really strong involvement, I think, both to sort of signal goodwill to the Soviets, to signal goodwill to the Soviets at a very, very tense moment. Khrushchev had been to like see an American singer during the actual crisis. And that was seen as a marker of like, oh, he doesn't hate us. Like this could work out. But also in the US, Kennedy was like projecting this image of being a statesman. And so entertaining the Soviet graciously entertaining the Soviet dancers and like welcoming them in his tuxedo at the ballet looked really good for that too. In terms of life going on, yeah, I mean, I think it did. And I think we're living during the pandemic. And I think we are all coming to know, I mean, in some ways, our life has shut down because of the ways that the pandemic has raged on. But at the same time, like, we have all learned that you can live with stress about world events, but still like have to do your job. You know, and I think my impression of reading newspapers and reading about the dancers from this period is that that's basically what's going on, is people were continuing their lives while feeling a lot of stress about what was going to happen in the future.
Well, this is just a fantastic book, eminently readable, so interesting, and, you know, just really such a fascinating book. So I hope that our talk today has sort of wet people's appetites and they'll go and read the whole thing, because believe me, there's plenty that we didn't get a chance to talk about. But now that you finished this big project, what is on the horizon for you now?
So I still want to work on music and dance because that's very, very dear to my heart. I'm interested now, I'm working on this project about minimalist music and ballet in the 1980s, 90s, and I think maybe up to the present. Haven't quite decided on its parameters. But because American ballet was so involved in music and sort of new music in the 1950s and 60s, after Balanchine's death, there's this sense of loss and what are we going to do? And one of the things the New York City Ballet does is turn to minimalist music, which was the style of super repetitive music by Philip Glass and Steve Reich. And I'm really interested in how that changes the way that time and meaning work in ballet, because they were mapping so much onto music that when you change the style of music, I really think a lot changes in what's going on in the ballet. And to me, it also is a really interesting moment where minimalism was moving from being this like hippie music where you do drugs and then bliss out to hours of repetitive music towards this like really institutionalized music that now when we hear it often like signifies things like money and cities and computers. And I think that this moment where it, I don't think that happens because of dance, but I think that the use of it in dance has a lot of things to say about how people are hearing it differently. So that's what I'm working on right now.
That sounds absolutely fascinating and a great way to sort of complement the work that's going on in minimalism in other spaces, like, you know, minimalism in opera, for instance. I think there's probably going to be a lot of not crossover, but maybe resonances in those two things.
The ballet that I'm working on right now, glass pieces. The third section of it is actually pulled from Philip Glass's opera Akhenaten. And in fact, this was the premiere of that music. It hadn't actually debuted as an opera yet, but it got used in this ballet, like this section of it got used in the ballet before it actually premiered.
Oh my gosh. So there you go. Well, that sounds very interesting, and good luck on that. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Kristen Turner, and I've been speaking with Anne Searcy, author of Ballet in the Cold War, A Soviet-American Exchange. Thank you so much.
Thank you.